Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Buried in the bitter waters. You deal a lot with one group, specifically white people, being or feeling that there is some sort of threat from black people and acting in an aggressive manner in response to that threat. I guess I wanted to start with terms. You point out in your book, which I loved very early on, I think page 12, language is how we understand things. You did not use disturbing situation. You use the term racial cleansing. Can you kind of share that thought process with our listeners, why you chose that term?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And really, it's to my mind, central to the book and central to the research. One of the things that struck me, as I did this research, was there was a pattern to these racial cleansings, which was obviously, you have the initial incident where whites issue an ultimatum to blacks, and they say, you know, you must leave in 24, 72 hours a week, or we will kill you. And those threats were successful. And then after that, there comes a period where immediately after the racial cleansing, where typically the white community would look back on this with some pride, you know. And I came across documents and speeches and pamphlets in which the white community would promote their county or their community. And one of the selling points was that there weren't any blacks. And, you know, this was considered really, you know, just wonderful. And that was followed usually a long period of time, 50, 60 years, was followed by a kind of a dawning realization that what had happened, that what Grandpa and Grandma had done was really pretty awful. Then the white community would construct a fable. And the fable would explain that, yes, something terrible had happened, and actually wouldn't even admit that something terrible had happened. Something had happened. And as a result of that, all the blacks left. But no one was injured. And the point of the fable was to absolve whites of any guilt for driving out all these innocent people. And by the time I come along, these fables are deeply embedded in the white community. And I will argue that not only within that community, but more generally among whites in the country. And there are a whole host of reasons for that, but let me just leave it there for the time being. And one of the ways that you enable this fable is through kind of code words and dog whistles. And so there was, you know, there was never racial cleansing. People just left, or there was a disturbing situation. That was how it was referred to by one person. The disturbing situation involved the death of several people, burning of houses. It was really grotesque, that particular racial cleansing. And when I realized what was taking place here, I decided first we needed to name this thing, to face it. We can't use code words to describe it. We have to describe it accurately. And the closest I could come, and I think it was pretty successful, was that this was a racial cleansing. And of course, that goes back to the war in the Balkans, and at that time it was called ethnic cleansing. But in point of fact, it, I think, very accurately defines what took place. And racial cleansing has been defined by the United Nations, which they did that in terms of ethnic cleansing. But you know, you replace, let's say, Serbs and Croats with blacks and whites, and you really have the exact same thing taking place. And so that's why I use the term racial cleansing. And what was disappointing, but at the same time interesting to me, was that when it finally came time for Cox Newspapers to publish this series, one of the conditions under which they would publish the series in the newspaper was they had to take out the word racial cleansing. And so, you know, it's still that undertow of racist thinking that still controls here. And they could not bring themselves to name what was in fact right in front of their face. And it taught me just how powerful this is as a theme in American life.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, March 21, 2019. So I have been told this is the first full day of spring, they tell me. Lovely day again in Seattle, and it's not even as nice today as it has been the last 3-4 days. Today it's only sunny and 60 degrees. We have been so spoiled. Anywho, book club. James Loewen, suspected race soldier. Sundown Towns, The Hidden Dimension of American Racism. A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, excuse me. His book we are picking up. This is our third session on Mr. Loewen's book. The audio segment that we heard at the beginning of the program, that was from Elliot Jaspin, different white man. He was on the program Cal's Decade in 2010, Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansings. We discussed his book. Lots of important information. Something that he stressed on that broadcast was that this is not a one-time thing. Rosewood, Tulsa, any of these incidents, that these, according to the evidence, he emphasized after looking at census records, going over data, that this sort of thing has happened. Whites using violence to evict all of the black people, that this has happened at least 260 times, at least. That was a major point of emphasis and why I think that book is so important. You can go back and listen in the archives. One final thing I'll share before we get started. The word hidden keeps being used, and I think that is substantially different. Mr. Jaspin said that at the end of his audio segment, that the white people at Cox Media, that they refused to see what was in front of their face. And that's not it at all. It's, in my view, it's totally different when you have whites who are committed, isn't that what the definition says? Dedicated to racism, white supremacy. That's, oh, we're not going to use the correct terms to call this. We're going to obfuscate. We're going to practice deception. Master deceivers call things by their proper name. Sundown Towns, James Lowen, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one. We are picking up on the section, The Great Retreat Was National.
The Great Retreat was national. What happened next was national, not regional, and affected America's largest minority, far more than the 100,000 Chinese Americans then in the country. From town after town, county after county, even from whole regions, African Americans were driven by white opposition, winding up in huge northern ghettos. Sometimes this was accomplished by violence, sometimes by subtler means. The next chapter tells how sundown towns were created. Here, it's important to understand that we're not talking about a handful of sundown towns sprinkled across America. The Great Retreat left in its wake a new geography of race in the United States. From Mayaca City, Florida, to Kennewick, Washington, the nation is dotted with thousands of all-white towns that are, or were until recently, all-white on purpose. Sundown towns can be found in almost every state. This chapter takes us on a whirlwind journey around the United States, exploring sundown towns and counties in every region. Independent sundown towns are fairly common in the East, frighteningly so in the Midwest, non-traditional South, and Far West, but rare in the traditional South. Sundown suburbs are common everywhere, although they're now disappearing in the South and Far West. Indeed, because sundown towns proved to be so numerous, this chapter proved the hardest to write. If it described, or even merely listed, sundown towns by state, the chapter would become impossibly long. But if it only generalized about the extent of the problem, it would be unconvincing. I tried to find a middle path, a mix of examples and generalities. County populations show the Great Retreat. One way to show the Great Retreat is by examining the population of African Americans by county. Between 1890 and 1930 or 1940, the absolute number of African Americans in many northern counties and towns plummeted. As a result of the relatively welcoming atmosphere of the 1860s to 1880s, only 119 counties in the United States, excluding the traditional South, had no African American residents in 1890. But by 1930, the number of counties with not a single African American had nearly doubled to 235. Counties with just a handful of African Americans, fewer than 10, also increased from 452 in 1890 to 694 by 1930. Many entire counties that had African Americans in 1890 had none by 1930. Other counties with sizable black populations in 1890 had only a handful of African Americans by 1930. These findings fly in the face of normal population diffusion, which would predict continued dispersal over time. Thus, the number of counties with no members of a group would normally decrease, even if no new members of the group entered the overall system, just from the ordinary haphazard moves of individuals and families from place to place. That the opposite happened is quite surprising, and indicates the withdrawal of African Americans from many counties across the northern states. The data reveal the startling extent of the Great Retreat. every Arizona county had at least one African American in 1910, the first year for which data exist, but by 1930, one Arizona county has no African Americans at all. One county's not worth reporting, but the trend grows more pronounced in Arkansas, which also had no county without African Americans in 1890, but had three by 1930, as well as five more with just a handful. The pattern then holds with remarkable consistency in California, Colorado, and all the rest. Of the 39 states surveyed, not one showed greater dispersion of African Americans in 1930 than in 1890. In 31 of 39 states, African Americans lived in a narrower range of counties in 1930 than they did in 1890. Minnesota showed a mixed result. And seven states, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island, had virtually no counties in either year with fewer than 10 blacks. However, there too, African Americans concentrated in just a few counties in 1930 to a far greater extent than did whites. Thus, those states also fit the pattern. Hence, every state surveyed shows some confirmation of the Great Retreat. Some of the statewide retreats are dramatic. For example, African Americans lived in every Indiana county but one in 1890. By 1930, six counties had none, and another 14 had fewer than 10 African American residents, even though many more African Americans now lived in the state. I've confirmed 18 Indiana counties as sundown throughout or in substantial part. Moreover, in 1890, every county in the state of Maine had at least 18 African Americans, except one with just two and another with nine. By 1930, Maine looked very different. Now, five counties had eight or fewer African Americans. Several showed striking drops in their black populations. Lincoln County, from 26 to 5, for example, and Piscataquis, from 19 to just 1. Hancock County dropped from 56 in 1890 to just 3. Yet Hancock had more than 30,000 people in 1930. Geography doesn't seem to account for these declines. The counties with fewer than 8 African Americans were sprinkled about, not concentrated in Maine's isolated rural north. The Great Retreat and the Great Migration. These decreases to no or only a few African Americans by 1930 came in the teeth of huge increases in the black population nationally and in many northern states. Nationally, the number of African Americans went up by nearly 60%, from 7,388,000 in 1890 to 11,759,000 in 1930. Moreover, beginning about 1915, African Americans from Dixie started moving north in large numbers, a movement now known as the Great Migration, in response to the impact of World War I, which simultaneously increased the demand for American products abroad and interfered with European migration to northern cities. More than 1 million African Americans moved north between 1915 and 1930. Thus, the absolute declines in black population by 1930 in many northern counties are all the more staggering. Without a retreat to the cities, these increases in overall black populations would have caused the number of counties with zero or few blacks to plummet. Coming in the middle of the deepening racism of the nadir, this great migration prompted even more white northerners to view African Americans as a threat. A 1916 editorial from Beloit, Wisconsin, exemplifies the Negro as problem rhetoric. The Negro problem has moved north. Rather, the Negro problem has spread from south to north. Within a few years, experts predict the Negro population of the North will be tripled. It's your problem, or it will be when the Negro moves next door. With the black tide setting north, the Southern Negro, formerly a docile tool, is demanding better pay, better food, and better treatment. It's a national problem now instead of a sectional problem, and it has got to be solved. Historians and sociologists took note of the growing urban concentration of African Americans between 1890 and 1930, continuing to about 1960. One of the foremost writers on race relations of the era, T.J. Woofter, Jr., put it this way: "It is remarkable that Negro city population should have increased by 1.5 million between 1900 and 1920. But it's astounding that 1 million of this increase should have been concentrated in the metropolitan centers of the East and the Middle West. More than half of this increase was absorbed by just 24 cities, each having black populations of more than 25,000, he observed. This emphasizes the astonishing degree of concentration that has taken place. But neither Woofter nor other commentators noted the decreases in black populations, often to zero or to a single household, in smaller cities and towns across the North. The great migration seems to have masked the great retreat. Scores of books discuss the great migration. None tells of the great retreat, by this or any other name. The increased black population in, say, Chicago, got ascribed to migration from Mississippi, which was largely true. Hence, the internal migration of African Americans from small towns in Illinois to Chicago went unnoticed. Not grasping the extent of anti-black sentiment in smaller northern towns during the nadir, social scientists somehow found it natural for people from tiny Glen Allen, Mississippi, to wind up in Chicago, for those from Brownsville, Tennessee, to move to Decatur, Illinois, and for inhabitants of 96 South Carolina to move to Washington, D.C. This isn't how other migrations to the North worked. People from small villages in Italy often wound up in places such as Barre, Vermont, or West Frankfort, Illinois, as well as St. Louis. Norwegians went to Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, not just Minneapolis. But this wasn't true of African Americans, not after the 1890s, anyway. Indeed, historians and social scientists have used the Great Migration to explain the increased racism in the North. That is, they used documents such as the Beloit editorial to explain the increased segregation African Americans experienced. The masses of newcomers strained the system, threatened whites' jobs, upset existing equilibriums, and the like. But the Great Migration did not cause the Great Retreat. Whites were already driving African Americans from small towns across the Midwest before those towns experienced any substantial migration from the South. They continued to drive out blacks from towns that never saw any sizable influx after 1915. The Great Retreat started in 1890, a product of the increasing white racism of the nadir. It can't be understood as a reaction to a migration that started in 1915. Now let's tour the country, seeing the profusion of sundown towns almost everywhere, beginning in the Midwest. In the process, we'll visit towns that excluded not only African Americans, but also Chinese, Jewish, Native, and Mexican Americans. And in a few cases, Catholics, labor union members, homosexuals, and some others. We'll see that prime real estate, elite suburbs, beach resorts, mountain vacation spots, and islands has typically been off-limits, and we'll encounter whole sub-regions where African Americans are generally not allowed, even in unincorporated rural areas. The Great Retreat in the Heartland. I did more research in Illinois than in any other single state. African Americans lived in every Illinois county in 1890. By 1930, 6 counties had none, while another 11 had fewer than 10 African American residents. Without a doubt, exclusion underlies these numbers. In Illinois and elsewhere, entire counties developed and enforced the policy of keeping out African Americans. Many of the towns confirmed as sundown towns in my research are county seats, and when they went sundown, often, not always, the rest of the county followed suit. I've confirmed that 10 of these 17 counties had gone sundown by 1930, and suspect all 17 did. Various written and oral sources tell of Illinois counties that kept out African Americans as a matter of county policy. Malcolm Ross of the Fair Employment Practices Commission wrote about Calhoun County, for example. Calhoun County is recorded in the 1940 census as 8,207 whites, no Negroes, no other races. This is not by accident. Calhoun people see to it that no Negroes settle there. According to an 83-year-old lifelong resident of Mason County, north of Springfield, the sheriff would meet blacks at the county line and tell them not to come in. Mason County has remained all white for many decades, despite its location between Springfield and Peoria, both with large African American populations, and on the Illinois River, an important trade route. But county data can only hint at the extent of the problem, because county is such a broad unit of analysis. Illinois may have had 17 sundown counties in 1930, but it had far more sundown towns than that. Town is a more useful jurisdiction to examine. In 1970, when sundown towns were probably at their maximum, Illinois had 621 towns larger than 1,000 people, ranging from Wyonette with 1,005 to Chicago. Of these, 424, or almost 70%, were all white, as defined in Chapter 1, in census after census. In addition, my universe of towns must include 50 hamlets smaller than 1,000 that came to my attention because of evidence confirming them as sundown towns. Therefore, my list of Illinois towns totaled 671, ranging from tiny hamlets to Chicago. Of these 671 towns, 474, or 71%, were all white, while 197 had African Americans. Of course, the mere fact that they were all white does not confirm the 474 as sundown towns. That requires information as to their racial policies in the past. I was able to get such material on 146 of the 424 all-white towns larger than 1,000. Of these 146, I have confirmed 145 as sundown towns or suburbs, or 99.5%. In addition, the 50 hamlets smaller than 1,000 in population were confirmed as sundown towns. Confirmed Illinois sundown towns range in size from communities of just a few hundred people to Cicero, which in 1970 had 67,058 residents, and Pekin, which in 1970 had 31,375, and another 3,500 in its suburbs. If 145 of the 146 suspected sundown towns larger than 1,000 on which we have information indeed turned out to be confirmed, what can we predict about the remaining 278 towns on which we have no historical information beyond census data? Our best estimate would be that 99.5%, the same proportion as among the towns we've checked out, or about 277 of them, would be sundown towns. There's no good reason to suppose the next towns will be different from those we know. We add to that estimate of 277 the 145 towns that I've confirmed, plus the 50 hamlets, and our best single estimate is that 472 of 474 all-white towns and hamlets were all-white on purpose. Therefore, our best single estimate is that 472 of the 474 all-white towns and hamlets were all-white on purpose. Of course, we wouldn't be surprised if only 465, 98% of the 474 towns turned out to be sundown, or if 473 were sundown. Applying the principles of inferential statistics, we can calculate a range within which we can be confident the true number of sundown towns will fall. Statisticians call this the confidence limits for our best estimate of 472, or 99.5%. They find these limits by computing the statistical formula known as the standard error of the difference of two percentages. Here, this standard error equals 0.0205, or 2.05%. The more rigorous confidence band used by statisticians is the 99% limit, the range that's large enough that we can be 99% sure that it includes the true proportion of sundown towns among the unknown towns. Here, that range is 5.3%. Accordingly, our estimate for the correct proportion of sundown towns among the unexamined towns would be 0.995 plus or minus 0.053, or 94.2%, to 104.8%. Of course, numbers above 100% are impossible. We can be 99% confident that the number of sundown towns among the unknown towns is roughly 94 to 100%. Or 261 to 278 of the 278 towns. Adding the 195 known sundown towns yields an overall estimate that the number of sundown towns among all 474 overwhelmingly white towns in Illinois, lies between 456, 96%, and 473, 99.8%. We can say with a 99% level of confidence that between 96% and 99.8% of all the all-white towns in Illinois were sundown towns. Our best single estimate remains 472, or 99.5%. Even this total, 472, isn't the full number of sundown towns in Illinois. I included communities smaller than 1,000 inhabitants only when informants or written sources brought them to my attention. These 50 confirmed sundown hamlets persuaded me to be suspicious of even very small all-white communities. Many other hamlets no doubt kept out blacks. Also, various sundown towns larger than 1,000 in population missed getting on my radar in the first place. Owing to non-household African Americans such as prisoners. These sundown towns are spread out throughout the state. Southern Illinois had many. Central Illinois has just as many. Oral history confirmed some 36 communities as sundown towns just within a 60-mile radius of Decatur, and written documentation confirmed another dozen. Northern Illinois has even more, owing to the sundown suburbs ringing Chicago. As a correspondent suggested about Ohio, instead of studying sundown towns, perhaps I should have researched the exceptions, towns that never excluded blacks, since that would be a more manageable number. Before we leave Illinois, this statistic of 472 probable sundown towns might come alive if I supply examples. I've chosen three, one from each section of the state. LaSalle and Peru in northern Illinois are separate towns, each with its own library, city hall, etc. But they share a high school and a common boundary, and most people consider them really one entity. I don't know when they first became sundown towns. Not one African American lived in the towns on the eve of the Civil War, when their combined population was 8,279. Even back then, the absence of blacks was surprising, since both towns lie on the Illinois River, a major artery, and on the Illinois-Michigan Canal, connecting Lake Michigan to the river at Peru, which opened up a water route from New Orleans to the Great Lakes. By 1860, when railroads became dominant, LaSalle, Peru found itself equally favored, being on the main line of the Illinois Central as well as the Rock Island Line, a major east-west railroad from Chicago. These trade routes surely would have brought African Americans to LaSalle, Peru, had they been allowed. In 1864, seven African Americans from nearby Mendota signed up for the army and traveled with their recruiting officer to LaSalle to go up the canal to Joliet to be mustered in. In LaSalle, a gang of copperheads attacked them and drove them out of the city. Census takers in 1870 found only one African American in Peru. None in LaSalle. Yet the war had caused many African Americans to wind up in Cairo, whence they diffused throughout the Midwest, and the Illinois Central directly connects Mississippi, Cairo, and LaSalle, Peru. In 1880, LaSalle was the only city in Illinois, defined as larger than 4,000 in that year, with no African Americans. And Peru was one of only two cities that had just one. An 1889 article in the Chicago Tribune noted that this was no accident. The miners of La Salle, Peru, and Spring Valley do not allow a Negro in their city limits. Around this time, the towns apparently posted sundown signs, which stayed up until after World War II. The cities clearly still refused to let African Americans spend the night in 1952, for in that year, its high school band director had to skirt the policy to host an integrated college band. By 1970, their populations had grown to 22,508, of whom just five were African American. Again, these numbers are shockingly low, since the cities were now also served by U.S. 6, a major east-west highway from Atlantic to Pacific, and U.S. 51, which runs all the way to New Orleans and was the most important single highway in Mississippi before the advent of the interstate system. An undergraduate at the University of Illinois Chicago, who grew up in La Salle, Peru in the 1980s and 1990s, reported that La Salle, Peru High School stayed all white until 1998. Villa Grove, a central Illinois town 17 miles south of Champaign, Urbana, is newer and smaller than La Salle, Peru, but equally white. After I spoke in Decatur in October 2001, two people came forward to say they had heard that Villa Grove had, or has, a whistle or siren that sounded every evening at 6 p.m. to tell all African Americans to be out of town. I filed the story under Urban Legends, thinking it absurd that anyone could possibly worry that any substantial number of African Americans were clamoring to get into Villa Grove, a town of 2,553 people located on no major highway. The story did suggest that Villa Grove is a sundown town, however, so I visited the town. To my surprise, interview after interview confirmed the whistle story. Today, Villa Grove is both a local service center, supplying the needs of surrounding farmers, and a bedroom community for Champaign Urbana. Some Champaign Urbana residents move to Villa Grove and now commute to work to minimize their contact with African Americans in Champaign Urbana. One African-American woman at the University of Illinois told of conversations with a white colleague at her former job. He was a native of Villa Grove, as was his wife, from whom he'd separated. As he recounted it, his wife insisted that he wash his hands at her home before picking up their daughters for a weekend visitation, because she knew an African-American was employed at his workplace and they might have touched common objects. In July 1899, striking white miners drove a group of African-American strikebreakers down the railroad tracks out of Carterville, a town of 3,600 in southern Illinois. In the process, they shot five of them dead. Eventually, the whites were all acquitted, the strikers won, and all African Americans were forced to leave. Carterville had already pushed the sundown town concept to a new level before 1899, not permitting African Americans to set foot inside the city limits even during the day. This policy remained in force for decades. Even Dr. Andrew Springs, the black physician serving Dumaine, a small black community about a mile north of Carterville, had to wait at the edge of town in the 1930s for drugs he'd ordered from Carterville's pharmacy to be delivered to him. In the late 1970s, the first black family moved in. According to Carl Planintz, who's lived in Carterville for several decades. Ironically, their first night, there was a fire and their house burned down. Stories such as these exist for each town that I list as confirmed, and I believe similar information, differing only in detail, remains to be harvested from almost every one of Illinois's 474 all-white towns. What about other states? Roberta Seneschal, one of the handful of authors who've mentioned sundown towns, noted that such banning of blacks by custom and unwritten law from rural and small-town communities was not a phenomenon limited to Illinois. She's right, of course, so I widened my circle, turning first to Indiana next door. Indiana showed a similar pattern. Of course, of all states, Indiana is most like Illinois and borders it for 300 miles. In 1964, in an affectionate memoir, My Indiana, Irving Leibowitz wrote, "Intolerance was everywhere. Nigger, don't let the sun set on you here," was a sign posted in most every small town in Indiana. As in Illinois, whole Indiana counties kept out African Americans entirely, or restricted them to one or two small hamlets. Research shows 18 confirmed sundown counties and 15 suspects in 1970. In addition, many confirmed sundown towns lie sprinkled across Indiana's unconfirmed counties. Some Indiana sundown towns were famous for their policy. Elwood's moment of notoriety as a sundown town came in 1940, when native son Wendell Willkie was nominated for president there. Its population was then 11,000. As many as 150,000 people crowded in for the rally. Francis Peacock wrote a memoir about two black Republicans who never made it, George Sawyer and his father. In 1940, George and his father, an active Republican, were on their way to Elwood, Indiana, to attend a rally for Wendell Willkie, the Republican presidential candidate. When they arrived at Elwood that morning before the convention, they saw two road signs posted at the city limits. "Niggers, read this and run. If you can't read, run anyhow." And, "Nigger, don't let the sun set on you in Elwood." George's father turned the car around and drove back to Anderson, and from then on, he was a Democrat. I identified a total of 231 Indiana towns as all white. I was able to get information as to the racial policies of 95, and of those, I confirmed all 95 as sundown towns. In Indiana, I have yet to uncover any overwhelmingly white town that on-site research failed to confirm as a sundown town. 95 out of 95 is an astounding proportion. Statistical analysis shows that it's quite likely that 90 to 100% of all 231 were sundown towns. They ranged from tiny hamlets to cities in the 10,000 to 50,000 population range, including Huntington, former Vice President Dan Quayle's hometown, and Valparaiso, home of Valparaiso University. Surely Leibowitz was right. Indeed, almost four decades after Leibowitz wrote, my research uncovered oral or written history, usually from more than one source, of actual sundown signs posted in at least 21 Indiana communities. Most had come down by the end of World War II, but according to Mike Haas, signs in the little town of Sunman said, "Nigger, better not be seen here after sundown," until well into the 1980s. The most recent sign was spotted in White County in 1998. Intentionally, all white communities dot the rest of the Midwest. In Ohio, independent sundown towns are found from Niles in the north to Syracuse on the Ohio River, and sundown suburbs proliferate around Cincinnati and Cleveland. Missouri has an extraordinary number of sundown towns, at least 200. Many are in the Ozarks and will be treated later in this chapter. But the more Midwestern parts of Missouri have dozens of sundown towns and counties as well. In sum, by 1930, probably a majority of all towns in the heartland kept out African Americans. No wonder blacks moved to Chicago and St. Louis. Sundown towns in the far north. Clearly, sundown towns were a phenomenon throughout the lower Midwest. But what about states farther north? Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois border former slave states, after all, and Missouri was a slave state, so they were near black populations. Initially, I didn't expect to find sundown towns in far northern states such as Maine, Michigan, Wisconsin, Idaho, or Oregon. I labored under the misapprehension that all white towns so far north were unlikely to be purposeful. I thought that because these states were so distant from African American population centers, it may be unreasonable to expect their towns to have black residents in the first place. Also, I imagined that whites so far north, faced with no possible threat from any large number of African Americans, would be unlikely to adopt exclusionary policies. I was wrong on both counts. Take Wisconsin, for example, not usually considered a place where African Americans concentrated, except perhaps Milwaukee. In 1890, the state was indeed only 0.15% black. Nevertheless, before 1890, black people hardly limited themselves to Milwaukee. Only 8 of Wisconsin's 68 counties held no African Americans in 1890. Another 27 counties had fewer than 10. 26 counties had at least 20 African Americans, and these were sprinkled about the state. 4 counties around Lake Winnebago, Calumet, Fond du Lac, Outagamie, and Winnebago, boasted 389 African Americans among them, almost as many as Milwaukee. In all, 1,986 African Americans lived outside of Milwaukee, along with 458 black Milwaukeeans. By 1930, the number of African Americans living in Milwaukee had swelled almost tenfold to 4,188. While outside Milwaukee lived fewer blacks, just 1,623, than in 1890. In 1890, less than 20% of Wisconsin's African Americans lived in Milwaukee. By 1930, 72% did. The most dramatic declines came in the counties around Lake Winnebago, by 1930 home to just 86 African Americans, most of them in Winnebago County. Fond du Lac's 178 African Americans in 1880 dwindled to just 22 in 1930, and 5 by 1940. Statewide, 16 counties had no African Americans at all by 1930, and another 42 had fewer than 10. Among its 144 cities of more than 2,500 population in 1970, Wisconsin had 126 all-white communities, as defined in Chapter 1. No prior published histories treat the phenomenon of sundown towns in Wisconsin, so far as I know, And I couldn't spend nearly as much time doing oral history in Wisconsin as in Illinois and Indiana. Nevertheless, I confirmed 9 as sundown towns. For 10 others, including several towns near Lake Winnebago, I have some evidence. I'm sure that many additional Wisconsin towns, including several Milwaukee suburbs, also excluded African Americans, but haven't done on-site research to prove it. Some Wisconsin sundown towns were tiny hamlets. Even some unincorporated rural locales kept out African Americans by refusing to sell them land or hire them as farm labor. Some were startlingly large cities, such as Appleton, population 60,000, and Sheboygan, 45,000. Sheboygan, for example, acted as if it had passed a sundown ordinance. It had a police officer meet trains at the railroad station to warn African Americans not to stay there, according to a resident there in the early 1960s. At least one town, Manitowoc, posted signs, Gray Gundaker, now a professor at the College of William and Mary, saw them when he lived there from 1962 to 1964. The signs were worded approximately, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in our town," he recalls. "I think the words were in italics and painted across a picture of a green hill with the sun setting halfway behind it." Beaver Dam, 60 miles northwest of Milwaukee, grew steadily from 4,222 people in 1890 to 10,356 in 1940 and 14,265 in 1970. Despite this growth, its black population fell from 8 in 1890 to just 1 a decade later, then stayed at 1 or 2 until after 1970. A 1969 report at Wayland Academy, a prep school located in Beaver Dam, evaluated the feasibility of admitting Negroes to Wayland. Its authors interviewed townspeople to determine problems which might face a Negro as he lives in this presently non-integrated community. Several older inhabitants of Beaver Dam all said the same thing in the same words to Moira Meltzer Cohen, Beaver Dam resident and resourceful researcher. "A couple of black families tried to move in during the 60s and 70s, and they were run right out." Wisconsin exemplifies findings from other far north states. Oregon had just one county with no African Americans at all in 1890, although it had 16 more with fewer than 10. By 1930, however, Oregon had 4 counties with no African Americans and 20 more with fewer than 10. Exclusion was responsible. Correspondents have sent me evidence confirming that a string of towns along what is now Interstate 5 in western Oregon, for example, including Eugene, Umpqua, Grants Pass, Eagle Point, Medford, and others, kept out African Americans until the recent past. Other examples across the far north, from west to east, include Kennewick and Richland in Washington, Ashton and Wallace in Idaho, and probably all of Lemhi County, Austin, Minnesota, many towns in Michigan, and Tonawanda and North Tonawanda in New York, almost on the Canadian border. Wallace, for example, expelled its Chinese in the 19th century. In the 20th, it put up a sign at the edge of town that said, "Nigger, read this sign and run." And in the 2000 census, it still had no African Americans and just 1 Asian American. So even in the Idaho Panhandle up by Canada, towns felt the need to keep out people of color. The Great Retreat didn't strike the traditional South. Very different race relations evolved in what I call the traditional South: Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana, all states historically dominated by slavery. There, in contrast to the North, slavery grew more entrenched after the American Revolution. Some whites grew wealthy from the unpaid labor, and most others yearned to emulate them. After slavery ended, the tradition continued in the form of sharecropping, which kept many blacks in peonage, unable to pay the perpetual debt by which white landowners bound them to the land. In towns, blacks continued to do the domestic chores, janitoring, and backbreaking work that whites avoided, now in exchange for inadequate wages. To hire blacks, whom they could pay less than whites, was in the interest of plantation owners, railroads, and other employers. County populations in the traditional South don't show the Great Retreat. Indeed, during the nadir, when sundown towns were most in vogue, whites from the traditional South expressed astonishment at the practice. Why expel your maid, your agricultural workforce, your school janitor, your railroad track layers? Writing about Washington County, Indiana, Emmy Lou Thornbrough noted that African Americans were not allowed to come in even as servants, a fact which occasioned surprise among visitors from the South. Traditional white Southerners saw African Americans as workers to be exploited, and sometimes as problems to be controlled, but not expelled. Therefore, the traditional South has almost no independent sundown towns and never did. This doesn't make whites in the traditional South less racist than in other parts of the South or other regions of the country. Racist they were. Indeed, racism arose in Western cultures primarily as a rationale for racial slavery, but the tradition entailed controlling and exploiting blacks, not getting rid of them. Indeed, the original sundown rule was a curfew at dusk during slavery times. To be out after dark, slaves had to have written passes from their owners. After slavery ended in the traditional South, whites often lynched African Americans to keep them down. Elsewhere in the United States, whites sometimes lynched them, we will see, to drive them out. Thus, Mississippi, for example, has just two all-white towns with a population over 1,000, Belmont and Burnsville, and they lie barely in the state, in the northeast corner near the Alabama line in Appalachia. It also had three suburbs that excluded African Americans between 1945 and 1975. Alabama has two sundown counties and a handful of sundown towns, but all except one are in far north Alabama, in Appalachia, not in the traditional South. And the exception is a sundown suburb of Mobile. Louisiana has a few, but they're tiny. The cotton culture part of Arkansas boasts not a single sundown town. California has more sundown towns than all parts of the traditional South put together. Illinois has many times more.
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment, James Loewen, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. We'll pick up the next chapter is The Great Retreat from the Rest of the South. Next chapter for the book club. The number to dial if you have commentary to share, 641 715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Email if you would like to write in your commentary, if you're listening live and just aren't able to call, or if you are listening to the archive and want to write your commentary in to share as we proceed, untiljustice@gmail.com. We had quite a few folks who've already done that. Written commentary number one. I must say, I had to listen to this week's book reading twice. He's talking about last week, actually. I find the author, reader, to be a bit challenging, as his oratory has a religious zeal and pride with it. It can be difficult to separate or not be distracted by his passion about telling of the history or instructions to gain the full context of this period. I listened twice to be sure I received the data without the reading getting in my way. One thing I found interesting that I hadn't given much One thing I found interesting that I hadn't given much thought to was the role of the white immigrant in the mistreatment of blacks. While history would have you believe that northern whites were less racist, it may have been they hadn't had a 200-year head start. Of course, it didn't take them long to catch up in a global system. Lots of metaphors. Listening to the information while observing the reader has been highly constructive. Looking forward to next week, meaning this broadcast. More people wrote in. We'll read those as we proceed. Folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, folks with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing, Gus? It's Victor out of New Jersey. If my background is noisy, just let me know. Some things that I got. Pushing fleeing black people that was already in the North, and also blacks migrating in the city that created the ghetto. I always believe that and stress that the ghetto is a white racist creation. I was unsure why he referred to it as the Great Retreat. I think that also plays into what you just discussed as he speaks as, with some kind of pride to all this white terrorism. As I go back and forth, I'm also listening to this audio read, and I'm also listening to the warmth of other songs that white capital encouraged blacks from the South to come to the North for cheap labor, but offered no protection from white mobs. He also stresses, he mentions other groups, Jews, Japanese, Chinese, Mexicans. However, none of these groups suffered the brutality of blacks. As he points out, different politicians who come from sundown towns, it reminds me of commentator Fox News Bill O'Reilly, grew up in Levittown, and his racism and vitriol towards black people during his tenure at Fox News was very recognizable. Also, I'm gonna close. I have to go back to the warmth of other suns as I'm listening to that audio read. And it's just amazing. And it saddens me, the terrorism blacks went through during that time, that they thought that they were escaping white terrorism in the South. And as it the story of Dr. Fisher on his way to California, he couldn't find anywhere, no hotel that would take him as he crossed what he considered closer to California, which was getting closer to heaven. And also other blacks who viewed the North during the Great Migration as freedom. Little did they know that they were escaping right back into terrorism. And I'm going to close with a sundown town story. I'm from Newark, New Jersey. Really not a sundown story, but as after the riots of the 1960s in Newark, New Jersey, white fleet fled Newark, New Jersey, and they also fled East Orange and Irvington. Irvington, New Jersey, as I was a child, I remember as whites were leaving that city, that town, there was a rule, there was a police policy that after dark, sneakers were considered burglary tools. So any African-American walking the streets of Irvington, New Jersey, that had on sneakers could be stopped, harassed, and arrested by police because sneakers were burglary tools. I'm sure that that has its origin in the sundown town ideology. I'll close with that.
Much obliged, sir. I am obligated to give out a quick correction just because the lovely Isabel Wilkerson, author of one of Gus's top five books, The Warmth of Other Suns, it is Dr. Robert Pershing Foster, who had the difficulties migrating to California and still encountering white terrorism. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we've not heard from you at all, proceed.
Hello, have you heard Draftomania?
I heard a couple folks, I guess, Draftomania.
Thank you, I guess, for allowing me to speak first, and thanks for all that are heeding. I just have a quick question. I'm enjoying the book, enjoying the analysis more. Just had a quick question. Do you think, do any of the callers think that, you know how in the Westerns they used to say, get out of town before sundown? Do you think that has any origins to sundown towns? And that's all. It just ran across my mind as I was listening to the book.
I generally have heard that in, like, a law enforcement context, like somebody telling someone, you know, be out of town, you know, by sundown, as you said. That's generally the context that I think, you know, people say it, or stories and that sort of thing that I've heard about it. And absolutely, particularly since so much of what he's talked about in the text thus far has the police have been involved, the enforcement officers, as Mr. Fuller calls them, enforcing these codes about when the Negroes are supposed to be out of these geographic locations. So absolutely, I see the connection in that sense. I think,
okay.
Was that all you had, Draftomania?
Yeah, it's just funny how they just slide put things in these movies, and, you know, you won't even be able to know where the origins, you know, where they originate from. You know, it's like, you know, racism, white supremacy right in front of your face, hidden in plain sight. But if you don't know the origins of these things, they can, you know, make these commentaries or these metaphors, as you always say. And because you don't know the origins of the metaphors or what they really mean, they just go, you know, they're using another metaphor, they'll go right over your head. And that's all I have.
Indeed. Let's see. Irie in Louisiana mentioned not too many sundown towns in that part of the world. So he said, did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yes. Hi, good evening. He was saying that in the South, there weren't many sundown towns because, white people are comfortable being around us in an enslaved, capacity. Like New Orleans, you go around New Orleans, there are certain parts of town that you know black people don't live. For instance, St. Charles Avenue, certain homes in what they call the Audubon District or Audubon area, those are all multi-million dollar homes, mansions, and it goes without saying black people do not live there, but they do want the help, quote unquote, close by. But upon evacuating after the hurricane and coming to, going to Illinois and everything, I noticed blatant racism that I had never experienced in any part of Louisiana, let alone New Orleans. And for instance, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is closer to the border of Illinois, myself and my son and some friends were at the beach, and there was a big, F-250 truck that just kept going around the parking lot with what they would call a garrison size flag, which is a very large flag. But it was a Confederate flag, and it confused me because I was like, wait a minute, I'm up north, I'm in Wisconsin. What is this show of Southern pride about? And there are certain parts in Illinois and in Wisconsin that don't necessarily have that sundown. They don't do it that way, but you just know not to go in certain parts. So, for instance, I'm trying to say, like, Kenosha's really big. And so because it's really big, there are certain parts where, yes, there are black people, but then if you go more west away from the lake, it's going to be rural, and you just get the feeling like, I don't need to be in this part of Kenosha. But I'm not surprised at all to hear about there being blatant or outright sundown towns, because there was a march by the Ku Klux Klan in Madison, I want to say in the early 2000s. So not surprised at all, and I would advise people visiting family in the Midwest, be privy. And if you can avoid the Midwest, avoid it. I've been confronted by people in my vehicle because of whatever reason so many times, and threatened with violence over parking spots, over lane changes, all that. In the Midwest, the sundown, I would say, central of the United States, based on what I'm hearing in this book. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Gus.
Yes, ma'am. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we have missed you totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Man, most of my notes are from last week. Let me hurry up and get to it. First of all, I appreciate the comments from the caller from last week. We talked about the resistance. I always appreciate his commentary. I hope that he'll be able to call in more often to all the different programs that you have, Gus, on the Cows. He said, the author, last week that the Democrats rioted. No, white people did that. He used the term necrophobia, negrophobia, excuse me. Black white people ain't scared of us. They wouldn't abuse us if they were. We don't abuse them because we're scared of them. He said the North and the South mistreated us. No, white people did. He called the terrorist, the white terrorist, who was just doing all kinds of abusive things to us, in a sundown town or something like that. He called them rioters. He mispronounced, or at least the narrator mispronounced W.E.B. Du Bois' last name. And I think white people, it seemed like only with him, they don't know how to pronounce the word Du Bois. I think they do that on purpose. They talk about, in the book, it was talking about how that whites they viewed us as intellectually inferior. Didn't use that term, but basically that's what he meant. Only savages mistreat you over intellect. It's like if somebody is intellectually deficient, you're supposed to try to help them, not mistreat them. He talked a lot about progress again last week. We don't want progress. We want justice. As far as whites not wanting to live next to us, because he talked about that last week. Well, one reason they don't want to live next to us is because they don't want to compete for resources and for, I guess, areas that are well kept, which is still also resources. He made a statement that white supremacy. I think he said white supremacy. This is what he said. I think he said that if there were inactive white people, there would have been. I think he said the sundown towns would have ended or something like that. The interesting thing is, either he said white supremacy or the sundown towns, but I think he was talking about the sundown towns. But I would say white supremacy would have ended if there were inactive white people. There's no such thing as that, because even if they're not, I don't know, murdering you on videotape, they're defending it or something like that. They're always active in one way or another. Thinking about what he was talking about as far as the ghetto, I don't know if he mentioned it. I want to say he did mention it last week, but of course he has mentioned it earlier in this book. Interesting thing about, we hear about the ghetto a lot in the projects, but we don't hear about, you know, the trailer parks, which are much more dirty, I would say, in my view. And I would also compare that with the suburbs as well. Those are the most violent areas, you know, where the richer white people live. I mean, so you're talking about all these bank scams that they do. I mean, that nearly just bankrupt the whole economy in 2008, and just all these other things that they be doing. And I like the fact that the book that he talks about how the white terrorists, that they terrorize other non-white people as well, the Chinese and everyone else. I like that. Because it's like, you know, you could tell other non-white people, like, yeah, they're, you know, terrorizing all of us. So, you know, let's get together and do something about these terrorists. He talked about how when there were some sundown towns, other areas looked at that and they so-called copycatted that. They were copycats of that. Well, copycat, being a copycat suggests dedication or equals dedication, like in your definition of racism. He said that racial policies and exclusionary policies was responsible for that these sundown towns had racial policies and exclusionary policies. No, they had racist terrorism is what they had. And I'm almost done thinking about Milwaukee. It's interesting how he talked a lot about this week. He talked a lot about Milwaukee and the sundown towns around there. And then you see how black people are treated in Milwaukee today. And he did say, when he was speaking about a particular area that didn't have a lot of black people, he said exclusion was responsible as opposed to people. No, white people were responsible. And then he said a particular town, I can't remember what town it was, I'm almost done. He said that location put up a nigger threat sign, nigger don't come around here when the sun goes down or whatever. No location put up no sign. White people put up the sign. And then the last thing that I want to say is that last week it was stated that we are victims, but we don't have to feel like victims. Well, if I'm a victim, I want to feel like it so that I can solve the problem. That was all I had. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, guys.
Much obliged, Red. Just had someone else, a listener, talk about being reprimanded for saying that she is a victim of racism. That she was accused of wallowing. That's what it was. VGQ. Others that we've not heard from at all. If you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Did we nab everybody, or if folks maybe need a little time?
Daniel Hurt.
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Oh, yes. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everybody. Would I be correct in saying that the process of creating what the author is called Sundown Towns is similar to military action?
Well, it's a lot of war being discussed. He said violence repeatedly in the text. That's war, what he's sounding like. Mistreating people, use of violence unjustly. These sound like acts of war and involving the police, trained killers, armed with lethal force. So all of that would sound like, wartime military actions, in my view, acts of war.
Yes, although they did mention about violence, quote unquote, you know, dealing, you know, as far as physically dealing with the quote unquote black body, but along with military action, it's to move your enemy to a desired location for the advent of to be able to, in other words, if I want to be able to be more proficient in my mistreatment, I would have to move my enemy away from an environment where they could possibly prosper into an environment where they would, it'll be less of an opportunity to prosper. In other words, the quote unquote inner city movement that was made in that process to form a lot of the so-called sundown towns that are in the northern areas or Midwestern areas, as opposed to whatever was happening in the southern areas. That's what I'm getting from listening to the text. Because the author is constantly saying that these incidents that he was reporting on is not by accident. And when I hear somebody say that something is not by accident, that means they were actually sitting down or standing up and making plans, planning ahead of time, putting the plan in process. And assuring that they're going to get the desired results. That's what I'm hearing in the text constantly, even from the first readings. That's what I'm hearing. He may be stating more of the details that took place, you know, in formulating what is known as sundown towns, but my process, my mental process is he's stating, it's similar to what a administrative, you know, the generals and all of the planners, that level of people who are actually sitting around and saying, okay, we're going to move them from here to here. And in turn, we're going to restrict them so they have no other choice but to go there. And to go there in this particular case is what I'm talking about, is the is these quote unquote great migrations. Because people, which I think non-white people, especially non-white black people, were and are today, are desperate. They are going to head in a direction to whereas they assume or hope that it will be better than from where they were presently at. From what I'm hearing, it plays a part in my quote unquote family history, as far as the generation that was right ahead of me, like my mother and her brothers and sisters, were he's still somewhat is in the 19th century with some of his stuff, but he's also talking about the 20th century. In any part of the 20th century, they, especially the first maybe 20, 30 years, they definitely were a part of what I'm listening to, you know, as far as the, that process, because as you know, where I'm located at right now, which is not, but my family, both sides, is originally from the quote unquote state of Georgia. And they left for reasons on why the author is stating in the text. And so I'm just, you know, expressing what my brain is putting together. It's like a military operation. You know, it seems as though it's kind of like organized or loose. It is based on, you know, anger and whatnot. But in a sense, I try to look deeper than that. It's calculated. It sounds very calculated on as far as how he's explaining it. It sounds very calculated on what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what they expected the non-constructive outcome to be for non-white people and how they're going to benefit from it. And those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. If there are other folks who have commentary, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have commentary. Let's see. One of our other listeners, investors, wrote in, Mr. Lowen has a website, sundown.tougaloo.edu/index. Tougaloo is TOUGALOO. So it's sundown.tougaloo.edu/index. The website promotes his work and offers services for speaking engagements, probably $10,000. The interesting part of the site for me is that it was an interactive part to the website in which you can look up areas, towns, counties, and see if he considers it a sundown town. It also affords the opportunity to put in your own experiences into the database regarding various towns, in effect adding to the list of potential sundown towns. A few comments regarding the third reading. Number one, for example, African Americans lived in every Indiana county but one in 1880. By 1930, six counties had none, and another 14 had fewer than 10 African American residents, even though many more African Americans now lived in the state. This passage resonated with me, having grown up in Ohio. People of my parents' generation born in Ohio during the 1920s and 30s, and the children of people born in the South, thought Indiana was comparatively worse than Ohio regarding the racism practiced. Historical note, an assassination attempt was made on Vernon Jordan, civil rights activist, in 1980 by a white supremacist while he was in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He was accompanied by a white woman at the time, which may have precipitated the attack. Cowbell. Number two, I have gained a better understanding of the prevalence of sundown towns from the text. I was under the impression that it was mostly relevant to the southern part of the United States. My work environment in Indiana is almost entirely dominated by suspected racists, and as I have become more knowledgeable about racism, white supremacy, I have on rare occasions asked them questions about racism to test their knowledge. On one such occasion, I asked a female racist suspect who is in her late 40s about the term sundown town as it relates to Indiana, and she gave me the impression that she was very much aware of the term and how it applied to various communities in Indiana. I think this reinforced to me your, meaning Gus's, continual statement that white people are not ignorant about racism. Number three, the reading was also informative to me because it mentioned so many of the towns which I have either worked in, visited, or have family members who have lived or are currently living there. Appleton, Wisconsin,
Goshen, Indiana, Huntington, Indiana, Long Island, New York, Wrightsville Beach, North Carolina, Isle of Psalms, South Carolina, to name a few. For me, given how commonly the term is applied in the text, the question I have is the entire so-called United States just one big sundown town? We will stop there, although he does have additional points. I'll add those as we proceed. Some of the notes that I have, let me double check what the time is looking like, because this is a big book with lots of information. Okay, got that, with lots of information. And I hope folks, as I said, always take advantage of learning locally, nationally, globally. Be paying attention. I'm paying attention to Washington State and other areas that I have connections to. Virginia, of course. But pay attention, learn as we go. And the narrator, if folks have thoughts on how the narrator is contributing to the text, I think I said something about that before. I don't recall anyone making any comment on that, but I think that's something to make note of, share as we proceed. I enjoyed this week's portion of the reading more so than I have the previous sections of the text. I appreciated the information, the data, the analysis to some extent, even though I still saw where racism, white supremacy was being practiced at times. Some of the things that I appreciated when he definition of racism, white supremacy that's been used on this platform for a decade, global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. That word dedicated for a decade has caused problems on this here program. Man, oh man, music. When I was hearing the portions from this 2 weeks text, what did he say? He said, Calhoun County is recorded in the 1940 census as 8,207 whites, no Negroes, no other races. This is not by accident. Calhoun people should have been white Calhoun people. See to it that no Negroes settle there. Fact. Next highlight. I really appreciated, this is some of the words. What is it they say? It is the beginning of intelligence when you describe things by their proper name. I appreciated the section. This is the portion, The Great Retreat in the Heartland, where he takes so much time to talk about, are we talking about a county? Are we talking about a city? Are we talking about a town, and why that distinction is important? When he says, he has his table, and he said, table one is a useful way to summarize the entire northern United States. But county data can only hint at the extent of the problem because county is such a broad unit of analysis. Illinois may have had 17 sundown counties in 1930, but it had far more sundown towns than that. Several entire counties in Illinois allowed no African Americans except in one or two isolated locations, for example, but that one place sufficed to remove such a county from Table 1. Town is a more useful jurisdiction to examine. Most sundown towns in Illinois lie in counties that never appear in Table 1. Just in my opinion, very important. A lot of times nuance will be discussed and really digging in so that you get the full extent of the problem and not just glossing over and looking at this on a county basis and saying when you really get it out, when you really dig into the evidence, you see massive, wide-scale evidence of this being prolific and prolific in the north, as he's stating with these so-called sundown towns. Next, music, that dedication, the word dedicated. He says, of course, the mere fact that they were all white does not confirm that 474 as sundown towns. This is in Illinois. That requires information as to their racial policies in the past. I was able to get such material on 146 of the 424 all-white towns larger than 1,000. Of these 146, I have confirmed 145 as sundown towns or suburbs, or 99.5%. 1%. What does it mean to be white? I think something else that's been emphasized here for a decade is these things are not happenstance. This is not accident. When you keep seeing these types of things happen, this is dedication. The same way that he's describing it here, this is the way it should be talked about anytime, whether it's 2019, 1819, it doesn't matter. As long as we're talking about the system of white supremacy, the evidence and logic and the totality of history suggests all of this is with meticulous planning. It's not by accident. Continuing. Oh, wait a minute. Let me make sure I don't miss. He says, if 145 of the 146 suspected sundown towns larger than 1,000 on which we have information indeed turned out to be confirmed, what can we predict about the remaining 278 towns on which we have no historical information beyond the census data? Our best estimate would be that 99.5%, the same proportion as among the towns we have checked out, or about 277 of them, would be sundown towns. There is no good reason to suppose the next towns will be different from those we know. And the final sentence in this paragraph is, therefore, our best single estimate is that 472 of the 474 all-white towns and hamlets were all white on purpose. Enormous. What does it mean to be white? And he's just talking about Illinois. He hasn't even branched out into Indiana and Wisconsin and all these other areas. We could branch out to the whole world, but I mean, local, national, we'll stay right there for the moment. That is staggering implications for what does it mean to be white? Hundreds of towns just in one state. It's not by accident. That's what he said. This was on purpose. And to retired firefighter's point, even the terms that are being invoked in this text, retreat, calling them sundown towns. Now, I understand if it's, you know, the sign has got nigger, don't let the sun hit you. But I mean, let's put accurate terms on what this is. If this is terrorism, if this is military violence against the black people, campaigns, Negro extraction programs, well, then let's call it that. I would prefer Negro extraction campaign. Negro extraction pogrom, as they say, as opposed to retreat. I looked that word up. One, Dr. Cambon was with us yesterday, and he thought about the word retreat just with the cows, 10-year anniversary yoga retreat, California, July 3rd through the 7th. We were planning for the Virginia retreat last month. He said, I don't know, that word retreat, you know, it's falling back. Think about that. Nothing wrong with it. Just maybe there's a better word. That's all he said. Dr. Cambon. I look up the word retreat since that's what he's saying in this text. We have the nadir and whites have this great retreat, as he says in the book, where they start military campaigns to eject Negros. The word retreat, withdraw from enemy forces as a result of their superior power after a defeat. That's not what the Negros did. They were kicked out. White terrorism. That's not a retreat. The next one, move back or withdraw. It becomes so hot. Yeah, that's not it either. The next, withdraw to a quiet or secluded place. That doesn't apply either. Next, change one's decisions, plans, or attitude as a result of criticism from others. That's not it either. Next, decline in value. Not it either. Let's see. Move a piece back from a forward or threatened position on the board. In my view, that's not accurate either. I keep looking through all of these and none of these, even the military definition, a signal for a military force to withdraw. None of these apply to what he's talking about in this book. Black people being subjected to calculated white violence. That is not a retreat. There should be a better word. And particularly if that's going to be like the calling card of the text to keep coming back to this, the great retreat, that would be, and I'd put that right up there with race relations, because we could come up with a much more accurate term. Words are how we understand. That's what Elliot Jaspin said. Words are how we come to understand things. Let's understand this accurately. Terrorism. That's the word I keep invoking. Terrorism, deliberate, willful, white terrorism. Next. Oh, yeah, I thought this was great one. I thought this was great, and I thought this might have been an illustration of James Loewen practicing racism. So he's talking about Villa Grove, Illinois. I've never been there. So he does a talk there. He says, after I spoke in Decatur in October 2001, two people came forward to say that they had heard that Villa Grove had or has a whistle or siren that sounded every evening at 6 p.m. to tell African-Americans to be out of town. I filed the story under urban legends, thinking it was absurd that anyone could possibly worry that any substantial number of African-Americans were clamoring to get into Villa Grove, a town of 2,553 people located on no major highway. The story did suggest that Villa Grove is a sundown town. However, so I visited the town. To my surprise, interview after interview confirmed the whistle story. I thought that was super important. Number one, I think Mr. Fuller has said we should never be shocked about racism, white supremacy. I don't think any suggestion about what whites do to practice racism, even if there is no real threat from a Negro, if they just have made up in their mind, Negroes are a problem, we want to practice racism, white supremacy, and let's do it. We're going to erect a whistle. This will be our whistle blowing to keep the niggers out of town. And I don't care if there are no niggers within, 1,000 miles from here. We want to make sure it stays that way. So we're going to put up our whistle. None of these stories are beyond belief. Whites are dedicated to practicing racism, white supremacy. He continues talking about this town, Villa Grove, and going that, yes, they do have the whistle. I was wrong. And yes, this does seem to be a sundown town, tiny though it may be. So he says he's talking to this white guy who lived there. His wife lived there, too. And they got divorced. He says, and I thought this was interesting. So the white guy is divorced from his white wife. He, as they say, throws his white wife under the bus. Says, as he recounted it, his wife insisted that he wash his hands at her home before picking up their daughters for their weekend visitation because she knew an African-American was employed at his workplace and they might have touched common objects. I think it's significant because this white man married this white woman and had a child with her. I'm sure this was not the first time that she said something racist. I suspect if you grew up in this town and you selected this racist white woman, you're probably racist too. White people, they have a workplace racism is tomorrow. Whites are really slick at that. I would say in a workplace context, a white fellow to come up and say this sort of thing on the job to me, wow, you are super suspect. Not only did you marry a racist, your daughter's probably racist. You came from a whole town of racists. Wow, for you to tell me that and think that, oh, this is a swell fella here. He's anti-racist, just like that good old Timothy don't drink the Kool-Aid. Get out of here. Although I did appreciate the anecdote. Let's see, next one. The story about Dr. Andrew Springs this is all in Illinois, where they pushed out the Negros in Carterville. He says, Dr. Andrew Springs, the black physician serving Dumaine, a small community about a mile north of Carterville, black people don't have communities, had to wait at the edge of town in the 1930s for drugs he had ordered from Carterville's pharmacy to be delivered to him. In the late 1970s, the first black family moved in, according to Carl Planick, who has lived in Carterville for decades, suspected racist. Ironically, now this is in quotes, it says, ironically, their first night there was a fire and their house burned down. Now, all that's in quotes, so we think Mr. Planick, suspected race soldier, may have been the arsonist who burned down the house. We don't know. We thank him for sharing, but in my view, there should be a comment added there like, wow, again, this is deliberate, dedicated terrorism. This is not a retreat. This is coordinated, deliberate terrorism. Right up, not ancient history. This happened in the 70s, he said. Continuing, let's see. In my book, I have the ebook, there is a misprint. It says, Map 2 shows 18 confirmed sundown counties and 15 suspects in the 1970s. In addition, many confirmed sundown towns lie sprinkled across Indiana's unshaded counties. The narrator said unconfirmed counties. I just thought it was interesting that the word unshaded was used. On the very next page, it says they give this story. of, I'm just trying to make sure I get the Elwood, Indiana. We got another mention of Indiana. Francis Peacock, writing this memoir about George Sawyer, black male father trying to go to the Republican convention. The difficulty black Republicans have been having for years. Says when they arrived at Elwood, when they arrived at Elwood that morning before the convention, they saw two road signs posted at the city limits. Niggers, read this and run. If you can't read, run anyhow. And nigger, don't let the sun set on you in Elwood. George's father turned the car around and drove back to Anderson. And from then on, he was a Democrat. They just said the Democratic Party was the party of white supremacy for this era of time. Like, confusion is lethal. System of racism, white supremacy. And then they just change it around. It depends on what era it is. I'm upset that no good Donald Trump, I'm going to go to the Democratic Party, or, you know, whatever it is. I'm upset. No good. What's my man down in South Carolina? Pitchfork Ben Tillman. That no good Ben Tillman. I'm going to join the party of the Republicans. They get you. It's just different parties of the system of white supremacy. Copperheads, last thing I'll share. They had the anecdote in the text, white terrorism. I thought he should have explained this because I did not know what the term copperhead was when they're talking about back to Illinois. The trade routes surely would have brought African Americans to La Salle, Peru, had they been allowed. In 1864, seven African Americans from nearby Mendota signed up for the army and traveled with their recruiting officer to La Salle to go up the canal to Joliet to be mustered in. In La Salle, a gang of copperheads attacked them and drove them out of the city. I didn't know what copperheads were. He had to read the footnotes. The footnote reads, copperheads were pro-South Democrats, so-called pro-Union Republicans, pro-South Democrats, they called. Just make it plain for us. These are whites who are dedicated to terrorism, violence, abusing black people. Make it plain. But yeah, I didn't, the term copperhead, learned something new. We have about 4 minutes. Did any other folks have comments either about the narrator, questions that they wanted to share before we proceed next audio segment? The caller at 9086, did you have commentary?
Yeah, I sure did. Hi. I was just, because I started listening to it a couple days ago from the beginning, and I was wondering how everybody felt about the Clark family. I know that it was talked about in the warmth of other sons, but I don't remember them saying that they got terrorized when they got there. Then they went to the courts and sued for the right to stay there. Then they went back there and they couldn't stay there anyway. And this is nothing against the Clark family, because they didn't deserve this anyway. But would anybody on this line, if that was y'all, would y'all, if you went to a neighborhood and the people were terrorizing you, and then would you go to court to sue to stay in that same neighborhood again? I was really confused on that one. I'm trying to figure out why. What was up with that, with the Clark family?
Particularly for Chicago, we did a program in 2015 with Beryl Satter, a suspected race soldier, white woman. Her book Family Property, which talks about white terrorism and housing for black people in Chicago. And I think the Clark family is mentioned in that very book. I have to double check. But the gist of it, black people were in a horrendous condition. You can call this military white supremacy, military violence as well, with housing in Chicago. So that, okay, you're the Clark family. You don't want to go stay out here. With these whites, they're terrorizing you. You want to go back and stay with the niggers? Fine. You can pay quadruple the value for really, really dilapidated, property that is a fire trap where black people die all the time, like routine, the same way that they report about Chicago gun violence. They report about Chicago fires being death traps for the Negro housing where they warehouse the black people, and rats and lack of garbage pickup and, you know, everything horrendous that you can imagine that Dr. King complained about. It was so bad he had to send his child home when he went to live in the slums where they warehoused the Negroes in the 1960s in Chicago, and said it was the worst racism he ever experienced. The Clarks were doing this like 20 years earlier. So it was a horrible predicament either way. I think their logic was maybe we can get a better housing, better quality of life for ourselves, and we can make white people enforce the rules so that they won't terrorize us. There you go. But I think that was the logic they were using. You have bad choices, you know, bad choices abound with housing and black people. 2019-1950, anytime in the system of racism, white supremacy.
Most definitely. It's part of the terrorism and what they need to do to keep us in line. Mr. Fuller talks about it. It's like the constant movements that you have to do. You might have to move, you know, at any
seconds.
Time. I mean, it might be 50 years you'll be somewhere, and they'll still make you move, or 5 months. Okay, I'll say something after the next reading. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. We will leave it there and get to the second audio segment so that we have time for everyone if you have additional comments. This is James Lowen, Suspected Racist, Sundown Towns, audio segment number 2, The Cows.
The Great Retreat from the Rest of the South. More like the Midwest and West is the non-traditional South. Appalachia, the Cumberlands, the Ozarks, much of Florida, and North and West Texas. They're huge swaths of counties, as well as many individual towns, drove out their African Americans, beginning in about 1890. Follansbee, West Virginia, for example, kept out African Americans for years before the early 1920s. Then some mills brought in African Americans as employees. In October 1923, the Ku Klux Klan burned 2 fiery crosses and painted a threat on the fence facing the colored section, warning all blacks to leave immediately, according to the Pittsburgh Courier. They fled, and the sundown policy apparently remained in force, for in 2000, Follansbee had 3,115 people, but not a single African-American household. Much of the non-traditional South did expel its African Americans during the nadir. Arkansas shows the difference dramatically. In 1890, it had no county without African Americans, and only one with fewer than 10. By 1930, 3 counties had none, and another 8 had fewer than 10, all in the Arkansas Ozarks. I suspect all 11 were sundown counties, and have confirmed 6. If we draw a line from the southwest corner of Arkansas northeast to the Missouri boot heel, the resulting triangle bordering Oklahoma and Missouri includes all 11 counties and all 74 suspected sundown towns in Arkansas. The southeastern part of the state, in contrast, where cotton culture dominated and secession sentiment was strongest, includes not a single sundown town or county. Similarly, most sundown towns and counties in Texas are in North Texas, or southwest of Fort Worth, rather than in the traditionally southern areas of East Texas. Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri also show this pattern. Their sundown towns are in the hills and mountains, or are suburbs. Maryland's one sundown county, Garrett, is its farthest west in Appalachia. Garrett County had become overwhelmingly white by 1940. At least 2 far west counties in Virginia and 2 in North Carolina along with two counties and several towns in East Tennessee, also went sundown after 1890. So did six counties in North Georgia, including Forsyth, and most of Winston County in northern Alabama. Indeed, the Great Retreat was particularly pronounced from the non-traditional South. In the first two decades of the 20th century, whites expelled African Americans from almost the entire Cumberland Plateau, a huge area extending from the Ohio River near Huntington, West Virginia, southwest through Corbin, Kentucky, crossing into Tennessee, where it marks the division between East and Middle Tennessee, and finally ending in northern Alabama. In most parts of the plateau, throughout most of the 20th century, when night came to the Cumberlands, African Americans had better be absent. The 20 Cumberland counties in eastern Kentucky had 3,482 African Americans in 1890, or 2% of the region's 175,631 people. By 1930, although their overall population had increased by more than 50%, these counties had only 1,387 black residents. The decline continued. By 1960, the African American population of these counties had declined to just 531, or 0.2%, one-tenth of the 1890 proportion. Throughout the plateau, this decline was forced. Picking a few examples from north to south, Rockcastle County, Kentucky had a sundown sign up as late as the mid-1990s, according to George Brosey, editor of Appalachian Heritage. In the 1990 census, Rockcastle had no African Americans among its 14,743 people. Esther Sanderson, historian of Scott County, Tennessee, made clear her county's policy. There was a big sign on the road at the Kentucky state line and at the entrance at Morgan County, the next county south. "Nigger, don't let the sun set on your head." The Negroes rarely ever passed through. If they did, they made haste to get through. Farther south, the sundown policy of Grundy County, Tennessee, garnered national attention in the 1950s when Miles Horton defied it and located his Highlander Folk School, famed for training civil rights leaders, there. Highlander's interracial policy was unpalatable to the county, so in 1959 they got the Tennessee legislature to investigate the school. Eventually, Grundy County took Highlander to court and forced the institution to leave, charging Horton with beer sales on its property. Did race have anything to do with it? Paul Cook, Grundy County resident and a member of the jury that found Highlander guilty, assures us it did not. That integration business, that didn't have anything to do with it. Lots of folks around here resent the colored, and we still don't have any in this county. But they'd have been in trouble without the niggers. The Cumberland Band of sundown towns and counties then continues across the Alabama line into the Sand Mountains, notorious in the 1930s and 40s for their sundown signs. Historian Charles Martin told of an old-timer, interviewed by one of his students, who used the usual sundown problem rhetoric. "We didn't have any racial problems back then. As long as they were off the mountain by sundown, there weren't any problems." The Ozarks also went sundown after 1890. No county in Missouri had zero African Americans in 1890, but by 1930, most of the Ozarks were lily white. The same thing happened across the state line in Arkansas. In 1923, William Pickens saw sundown signs across the Ozarks. And in 2001, Milton Rafferty noted that the black population of the Ozarks declined from 62,000 in 1860 to 31,000 by 1930. The sundown policy of the Arkansas and Missouri Ozarks spilled over into northeastern Oklahoma, leaving most of two counties all white there. Noting sundown signs still extant in the 1970s, sociologist Gordon Morgan said African Americans in the Ozarks had coined a new term for the towns they marked, gray towns. So far as I know, this term wasn't used outside the Ozarks. Morgan goes on, "In the not too distant past, some vigilante whites thought their duty was to police the towns and, with the tacit support of the law, proceeded to harass any black people who might pass through. Some cars carrying blacks have been stoned and weapons have been brandished by whites. Even today, some blacks will not stop in these gray towns for gas or food, even though discrimination in the public places is forbidden." In 2002, some African Americans who live near the Ozarks said they still avoid the region. The Great Retreat in the West. During the Great Retreat, from every state in the Great Plains and Rocky Mountains, African Americans left most rural areas and retreated to a handful of cities with black population concentrations. Every state in the Great Plains and Rocky Mountains also saw a decline in overall black population percentages. States that had no centers of black population for African Americans to retreat to even saw declines in their absolute numbers of African Americans. The black population of North Dakota, for example, slid from 372 in 1890 to 243 in 1930. As a proportion of the population, blacks dropped from 0.2% in 1890 to a minuscule 0.03% by 1930. In South Dakota, the decline was from 0.16% to 0.09%. In Montana, from 1.13% to 0.23%. Six counties in Nebraska that had 20 to 50 African Americans each in 1890 had just 1 to 8 by 1930. At the same time, Omaha and Lincoln doubled in black population. Wyoming, the equality state, had the largest proportion of African Americans in any of these states, 1.52% in 1890, its year of statehood. But by 1930, blacks were only 0.55% of its population. Utah's blacks likewise decreased as a proportion of the population, and those who remained beat a retreat to Salt Lake and Weber, Ogden, counties. By 1930, 88% of the state's African Americans lived in those two counties. Again, these declines were hardly voluntary. We've already seen how, especially in the West, expulsions and prohibitions have been directed not only at African Americans, but also at Chinese Americans, and sometimes others. Indeed, Western locales established a bewildering variety of rules. Some towns in the West excluded Native Americans, but not Chinese Americans. Minden and Gardnerville are adjoining towns south of Carson City, Nevada. In the 1950s, and probably for many years prior, a whistle sounded at 6 p.m., audible in both towns, to warn American Indians to be gone by sundown. William Jacobson, Jr., an anthropologist who lived in Gardnerville in 1955, says it worked. Indians made themselves scarce. A Chinese-American family didn't have to leave. On the other hand, Esmeralda County, two counties to the southeast, allowed black residents but not Chinese. Meanwhile, Fallon, Nevada, had a big sign at the railroad depot that said, "No niggers or Japs allowed." And the newspaper in Rawhide, Nevada, bragged in 1908 that Dagos from southern Europe, as well as African Americans, had been kindly but friendly informed to move on. South Pasadena, a sundown suburb of Los Angeles, let in Native Americans while keeping out Mexican and Asian Americans. Historian Fred Rolliter relates how Professor Manuel Servín at the University of Southern California became the first Mexican-American to break the taboo in about 1964. Servín bought the Loomis House, a historic mansion. South Pasadena thought he was Native American, which was okay. What the city didn't know, Rolliter went on to point out, was that his family was from Mexico and had come to the United States in the 1920s. Thus, the anti-Mexican restrictive covenant was broken by a Ph.D. American Indian who happened to be Mexican. Other California towns also kept out Mexican Americans, including Chester, a lumber mill town north of Sacramento, and Palos Verdes Estates, an elite oceanfront suburb of Los Angeles. Historian Margaret Marsh points to the irony of its sundown policy. Palos Verdes excluded Mexican Americans from living in the estates, yet Mexican-inspired architecture was mandated in most of the area. According to the University of Colorado Latino-Latina Research and Policy Center, in the late 1930s, Longmont, Colorado, sported signs saying, "No Mexicans after night." In 1907, whites in Bellingham, Washington, drove out its entire Hindu population. Sikhs, actually, numbering between 200 and 300, during 3 days of lawlessness. The chief of police, according to a pro-police account written years later, recognized the universal demand of the whites that the brown men be expelled. So he had his men stand by while a mob did the work. Like the Chinamen who've never returned to Tacoma, the account concludes, the Hindu has given Bellingham a wide berth since. The Bellingham newspaper editorialized against the means employed, but expressed general and intense satisfaction with the results. There can be no two sides to such a question, the editor concluded. The Hindu is a detriment to the town, while the white man is a distinct advantage. Despite the West's patchwork policies, barring Native Americans but not Chinese here, Chinese Americans but not blacks there, Jews somewhere else, for the most part, as in other regions, racism has long been strongest toward African Americans. The West is dotted with independent sundown towns that kept out blacks, places such as Duncan and Scottsdale, Arizona, Murray, Utah, and Astoria, Oregon. California had just 8 potential sundown counties, but scores of confirmed or likely sundown towns and suburbs. Most suburbs of Los Angeles and San Francisco, and most communities in Orange County, were established as white only. Sundown subregions and deadlines. We've seen that entire subregions of the United States, such as the Cumberlands, the Ozarks, the suburbs of Los Angeles, went sundown. Not every suburb of Los Angeles, not every county in the Ozarks or the Cumberlands, but enough to warrant the generalization. In several sub-regions of the United States, signs in rural areas, usually on major highways, announced dead lines beyond which blacks were not to go except at risk of life itself. In Mississippi County, Arkansas, for example, according to historian Michael Dugan, a red line that was originally a road surveyor's mark defined where blacks might not trespass beyond to the west. That line probably continued north into the Missouri Boot Heel and west beyond Paragould, encompassing more than 2,000 square miles. In southern Illinois, African Americans weren't permitted to settle north of the Mobile and Ohio switch track. This has been a settled feeling for years, according to a 1924 newspaper report that described a series of attacks, arson, attempted murder, and dynamite, against blacks who tried to move north of that line, and against a white farmer in Elko who hired them. Unconfirmed oral history in East Wisconsin holds that there was a sign outside Fond du Lac along Highway 41, warning that blacks were not welcome north of there. This sign sighting needs corroboration, but is credible because, in addition to Fond du Lac itself, and confirmed sundown towns Appleton and Oshkosh, all towns north of that point were overwhelmingly white. The Arkansas and Illinois deadlines may still be in effect. As recently as 1992, a black friend said, "I can't go into that town," to reporter Jack Titchener when he proposed buying a bag of charcoal after dark in Karnak, just north of the Illinois deadline. However, African Americans do live north of the Wisconsin line without difficulty today. From west to east, other confirmed sundown subregions, not just individual counties or towns, include a 4,000 square mile area southwest of Fort Worth, Texas, including Comanche, Hamilton, and Mills counties, where whites drove out African Americans in 1886, a thick band of sundown counties and towns on both sides of the Iowa-Missouri border, virtually every town and city along the Illinois River, from its mouth at the Mississippi, northeast almost to Chicago, except Peoria. Still, other subregions need confirmation. More research is needed everywhere. The Great Retreat from Prime Real Estate. Another way of characterizing the distribution of intentionally white communities in the United States is by type rather than location. From the Great Lakes, moving east to New England, then south to Florida, and then again in California and Oregon, we see the practice of keeping African Americans, and often Jews, off prime beauty spots such as islands, beaches, and coasts, and outside the city limits of oceanside towns. In mountain areas in the East, beginning in the late 1880s, many vacation destinations and retirement communities sprouted restricted signs, meaning white Gentiles only. Elegant seaside suburbs, such as Manchester-by-the-Sea, Massachusetts, kept out all Jews and all African Americans except servants living in white residences. Long Island exemplified the process in microcosm. Most of its beach communities kept blacks out, while the inside, the potato farm area, was interracial. Famous tourist spots such as Seaside Park, New Jersey, and Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, were for whites only. African Americans and Moors a local mixed-race people, worked in Rehoboth Beach, but couldn't live there, according to Elizabeth Baxter, who resided in Rehoboth in the late 1930s. This was confirmed by an 84-year-old lifelong resident. Nor could Jews. Islands and beaches in the Carolinas and Georgia, including Wrightsville Beach, North Carolina, and Isle of Palms, South Carolina, were all white into the 1990s. Florida's rimmed with sundown communities on both coasts. California had even more, especially clustered around Los Angeles and San Francisco. Some of these towns are elite, some multi-class, some working class. Several Florida beach towns, such as Delray Beach between Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach, kept out Jews but not African Americans. In 1959, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith described Delray Beach as one of the nation's most completely anti-Semitic communities. It quoted a leading Delray Beach realtor who proudly called it the only city on the east coast of Florida fully restricted to Gentiles, both in buying and selling. A longtime resident told me, mostly Northerners lived there, not Southerners, but they were just as prejudiced. They didn't want Delray Beach to become majority Jewish and garish like Miami Beach. At the time, Delray Beach had 5,363 African Americans in its population of 12,230. In the North, rarely did a place keep out Jews while admitting African Americans. On the Pacific coast, La Jolla, California, legally part of San Diego, but often thought of as an independent community with its own zip code, long kept out Jews, African Americans, and Mexican Americans. In 1925, the Parent Teacher Associations asked the La Jolla Civic League to prevent a Mexican squatter from occupying land he'd leased in La Jolla. According to Leonard Valdez of Sacramento, La Jolla was still keeping out Mexican Americans in the 1960s. Of course, Valdez noted, many retired naval officers lived in La Jolla, and there were no Mexican naval officers. Almost all suburbs were sundown towns. Residential areas near cities are also valuable real estate, of course, owing to their proximity to jobs, cultural venues, up-to-date health care, and other big city amenities. To a still greater extent than vacation areas, suburbs went all white beginning in about 1900. The so-called progressive movement, beginning shortly thereafter, was for whites only. Among its tenets was the notion that the big city and its ward politics, dominated by immigrants and the machine, were dirty. The answer was to move to the suburbs, leaving the dirt, vice, pollution, and African Americans behind. Across the United States, most suburbs came into existence well after the sundown town movement was already underway. In suburbia, excluding African Americans, and often Jews, became the rule, not the exception. As we saw in Mississippi and Alabama, even the traditional South wasn't exempt, developing its share of sundown suburbs mostly after World War II. Like beaches and resort towns, suburbs added another ground for exclusion, religion, that most independent towns ignored. Many, and perhaps most, suburbs of Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Los Angeles, as well as smaller cities such as Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, kept out Jews for decades. Long Island was especially vicious. Some suburbs kept out Catholics. Sundown suburbs continued to be developed rather recently, many between 1946 and 1968. The peak for independent sundown towns was probably reached around 1940. Between 1940 and 1968, a handful of independent towns went sundown, such as Vienna, Illinois, which burned out its black community in 1954. But African Americans successfully moved into a larger handful of sundown towns, such as Portales, New Mexico, in about the same year. Thus, the overall number of independent sundown towns dropped a bit after 1940. Not so for sundown suburbs. Until 1968, new all-white suburbs were forming much more rapidly than old sundown towns and suburbs were caving in. Thus, 1968 might be the peak year for independent sundown towns and sundown suburbs combined. To supply an exact number of sundown towns in the United States is hard, partly because it depends on the definition of town. But in many states outside the South, a majority of all towns can probably be confirmed as sundown in 1968. In all, I believe at least 3,000, and perhaps as many as 15,000, independent towns went sundown in the United States, mostly between 1890 and about 1930. Another 2,000 to 10,000 sundown suburbs formed a little later, between 1900 and 1968. The range is broad because I couldn't and didn't locate every sundown town in America. There are far too many. I've confirmed about 1,000 sundown towns and suburbs across the United States, but have left many more unconfirmed. Sundown neighborhoods. White America's new craze for all-white residential areas extended also into central cities and inner suburbs. As we've seen, African Americans were too numerous to be driven from larger cities such as Chicago and Washington, D.C., or medium-sized ones such as Omaha or Tulsa. But after 1890, neighborhoods within cities and inner suburbs increasingly went all white. As a rule, American cities hadn't been very racially segregated in the 19th century. During the nadir, that began to change. Cities and towns that didn't expel their African Americans after 1890 concentrated them into a few neighborhoods. Residential segregation increased dramatically within northern cities between 1900 and 1960. Even in places far removed not only from the South, but also from any large population of African Americans, blacks now found themselves unwelcome. Historian Howard Chudikoff describes the increasing residential segregation in Omaha. During the last decades of the 19th century, Omaha housing was available to all who could meet the price, blacks included. Beginning in 1902, however, the newspapers printed increasing numbers of housing advertisements specifying for colored families. For other groups, more freedom of choice prevailed. Roy Stannard Baker found residential segregation growing everywhere, including once liberal Boston. A strong prejudice exists against renting flats and houses in many white neighborhoods to colored people. The Negro in Boston, as in other cities, is building up quarters, which he occupies to the increasing exclusion of other classes of people. The Index of Dissimilarity, D, provides a common measure of the degree of residential segregation within a metropolitan area. When D equals 0, Integration is perfect. Every census tract has exactly the same racial composition as every other census tract. 100 represents complete apartheid. Not one black in any white area. Not one white in any black area. For values between 0 and 100, D tells the percentage of the smaller group, usually African Americans, that would have to move from disproportionately black areas to white areas to achieve a completely neutral distribution of both races. In 1860, the average northern city had a D of 45.7, only moderately segregated. If 45.7% of the blacks in an average city moved to predominantly white neighborhoods, the city would be perfectly integrated. Reynolds Farley and William Fry, premier researchers on residential segregation, point out that until about 1900, in northern cities, some blacks shared neighborhoods with poor immigrants from Europe. Even middle-class areas were interracial. Tiny cadres of highly educated blacks lived among whites in prosperous neighborhoods. Southern cities were even less segregated spatially, with an average D of 29.0. To some degree, especially in the South, these low Ds reflected the age-old pattern of servant housing near upper-class white housing. Even so, the low indexes reflected a lack of residential racial segregation, especially in working-class areas. After 1900, hostility ranging from shunning to violence forced the involuntary retrenchment of African Americans from dispersed housing in many parts of the city to concentration in inner city ghettos, an intra-city manifestation of the Great Retreat. By 1910, northern cities averaged 59.2 and southern cities 38.3 on the index of dissimilarity. Even larger increases characterized the next few decades. By 1920, D was above 80 in most northern U.S. cities, and the South was catching up. Northern cities averaged 89.2 in 1940, southern cities 81.0. By 1960, the average northern city held at 85.6, while the average southern city rose to 91.9. These are astonishing levels, considering that the end of the scale, 100, means not one black in any white neighborhood, and not one white in any black neighborhood.
Context of white supremacy is only astonishing if you don't understand what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be white. Number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Next week, we will pick up Creating All Black Towns. That's where we are for the section next Thursday. Folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, lines should be open. If you've not shared at all and think you have a question, comment, something you would like to offer on the text, you should go ahead and get a hand up now. Please do not wait until the last moment, especially if you've not spoken at all. Our caller at 9029, if you had commentary, you should be with us.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, callers and listeners. Thank you again, Gus, for the platform. The book is very interesting so far. Just received it last week, so I'm trying to play catch up a bit. Headed directly into the text, page 75. I thought it was interesting, top paragraph, basically, a little bit below it. Utah's blacks likewise decreased in proportion to population, and those who remained beat a retreat to Salt Lake and Weber. I think I was just interesting because we had the compensatory call speaking in regards to the athlete Russell Westbrook, who was basically being subjugated, and various other NBA players constantly complained about the racism that they dealt with in the city of Utah. So just having that come up, of course, puts things into context. The next page, 76, this is also something, again, this is also one of the things that I'm noticing is just how the dates are and the numbers. And we're talking about 1960, 1992, 2002. We're not talking about like centuries ago. We're just talking about recent history. This is not far gone. I mean, so what makes us think these areas have changed so drastically? I mean, why would they? And that being said, again, compensatory call-in. They were speaking about Los Angeles, and they're speaking about California, predominantly Orange County. And at the bottom of page 76, that's exactly what pops up. Most suburbs, Los Angeles, San Francisco, most communities in Orange County were established as white only. Makes perfect sense why in the call-in, the compensatory call-in, they were speaking about the racism that was going on in these high schools, Nazi stickers, nigger this, and all these other terminologies. It all, again, ties in. The following page, 77, at the top, this is something, again, where you look back at this, where this top paragraph, this has been a settled feeling for years, according to 1924 newspaper report that described a series of attacks, arson, attempted murder, and dynamite against blacks who tried to move north of that line, and against the white farmer in Elko who hired them, which is exactly what we speak about all the time, which is whites who do not follow along with the code get penalized. And that's very important. Even back then, they were willing to harm another white person just to let them know you're not allowing blacks in this area. I have a couple more things, but I know it's a little late. I don't want to go too far. Just I think it's page 81 where he mentioned the interracial diversity, so-called diversity up north. And this does make sense to some degree. I'm here in New York City, and we've had the village, the Central Park, which was actually an African village called Seneca Village. And it was owned by a black family. That village was actually very mixed, but predominantly black, but it did have, like he stated, foreign settlers that were white living amongst that black, living in that black village. And of course the city, so, quote unquote, took over the land and kicked everybody off. another so-called retreat. But great information. And it puts a lot of things into context. And I'll keep enjoying the reading. Thank you for your time and energy. Peace.
Much obliged, sir. Thanks for the commentary. Other folks who dialed in with a... Oh, I guess I could read our caller who shared notes. The last one, United States Big Sundown, number 4. The passage discussing the concentration of black people in Milwaukee, Wisconsin from 1890 to 1930 reinforced to me the systemic and coordinated approach that racist men and racist women have tied to dominating non-white victims. The text discusses what happened on the local level, but thus far neglects to mention that the purging of black people from these communities was reinforced by actions and policies at the state and federal government level. The work of Richard Rothstein, Economic Policy Institute, gives a detailed account of how the so-called ghetto was made by racist man and racist woman, which explains the horrible conditions of black people in Milwaukee today. I think a number of authors, Ta-Nehisi Coates comes to mind, black male, Beryl Satter, previously mentioned, also make a major point of emphasizing that exactly this was not just a few local whites sitting at the drawing board and coming up with their plan of sticking it to the Negros. This was federal, powerful whites coordinating locally, nationally, to really stick it to the Negros in a generational manner. Others that we've not heard from at all, or if you have a hand up, lines should be open. Feel free to share.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus. Man, this with this great retreat. First of all, he makes it sound like something pleasant. I'm saying, you know, the great retreat. There's so many different ways I guess you could go with that, and it also can remind you of something that's not pleasant, like the Great Depression. And he also, when he elaborates on it and talks about how, you know, we retreated, he makes it sound cowardly. And he made a statement about immigrants. I always, like, I don't know. I feel some type of way, I'll put it that way, when white people use the word immigrant, because, I mean, they're invaders. They're not in any position to call anybody an immigrant, no matter what the circumstances are. As far as the question that was posed of whether or not, you know, those of us on the line would sue the people in the same town that drove us out, had they not done that, I think that the question would have been posed, you know, would you just, you know, lay down? Would you just not do anything about them driving you out? Well, the interesting thing is, it's like black people can't win one way or the other. It's like we get condemned if we're doing something incorrect, if we respond, and we're doing something incorrect if we don't respond. And the interesting thing is that people responded even more aggressively, for lack of words, than that, where they not only sued people, they shot back. When, just as the gentleman from last week, one of the callers pointed out, that when the whites came and tried to drive out some black people in certain towns, and they shot at them and shot them and all of that, you know, they shot back. So, you know, any resistance that these people, I can't remember what the name of the family was who tried to sue them, that they did, any resistance that they had, I applaud them for any response, because to solve this problem, the solution to this problem is going to require that we don't lay down. It's going to require that we stand up and, like, come at these terrorists. We're going to have to respond to the violence that they continue to perpetrate against us. And I think that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Question that was asked after the first audio segment. Other folks with a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I had to divert from 99% of the second reading, but I did get back on to hear the very last seconds, and I thought I heard something about white people attempting to stay in areas where black people are residing. Am I correct on that? And if so, what was the context?
No, that's not what he said. The last portion of what he was talking about, he was saying that there are extraordinary levels of what he calls segregation, meaning white people living exclusively with whites and non-white people exclusively with non-whites. Astonishing levels. That was the last thing he was saying.
Oh, well, I mean, both were orchestrated by the same white people, correct? That's a question.
I believe so.
Oh, okay. Okay. I think in this book, he should include that. truth. Matter of fact, make it a practice to include that that non-white black people don't have anything to do with it one way or the other. As far as, like I said in the first half reading, that it sounds like a military operation. And this is something that white people do on a global basis. I can't get a better word from it for it, you know, to if I had to put it into one word or narrow it down to its least amount of vocabulary as possible, that's what I would say is a racist military operation. And that's just one, and that practice is just one example of it. White people would like to keep their incorrect and unjust environment pristine of their victims, only on a particular level. They want that interaction, which of course is sexual encounters, which ends up being rape, actually. I did hear about the work that they desired not to do, that sort of thing. They would have us in the environment, and then from there, then okay, well, nigga, go somewhere until I tell you to show up again. That's what it comes down. That's what it comes down to, and to accomplish that task, the author is just giving detail on how it got accomplished. I'm not gonna give a grade on the book as of right now, but he is giving some information on how the racist got that task done. He's given some details on it, on how did it get done. And I find that part to be informative of anybody that's a victim of racism, didn't quote unquote know that such thing exists, and then did not know on how it went about to being accomplished by the racists. Well, this book can probably be a source to have developed that understanding. And that's all I'll say right now.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks that have commentary, have a hand up.
Hey, Gus, to add to what the retired firefighter was saying about comparing it to a military campaign, I totally agree. It is, even when people say that we shouldn't wallow in victimhood, I mean, we are victims. And to point out the fact that you have economic embargoes placed on entire nations by white supremacists who are in charge of the United States and other Western.
We've deviated from the book. We've deviated from the book.
No. So yeah, we did. I'm sorry. But what I was saying was, I agree that, you know, this is comparable to military campaigns that's going on with Black Americans. As far as the family who sued to be able to stay in their homes, I do agree. There's really no place where we're safe or we're not victims of terrorism, whether it's in our communities with gentrification. So however, whatever tools we have at our disposal to fight white terrorism is acceptable. The police that would wait at train stations and also wait at the borders of these sundown towns and inform black people that they weren't allowed. It's really hard to understand why other victims don't understand why we're so suspicious of the police. The police has seems like throughout these stories, from sundown towns to the South, law enforcement played a big role in the subjugation and victimization of black people. That's all I got right now.
Much obliged, good sir. We have about 10 minutes left in the program, so if you think you have a question, comment you want to get in, do not wait. Go ahead and get your hand up immediately. A few of the notes that I have from the second portion of the text. If you are listening, you should definitely be paying attention for your geographic area or areas that you have connection to, areas maybe that you grew up in or places that you've lived, if someplace that you went to school or what have you, for a job or anything, or your parents, people in your family. Be listening out. You can share that information. Go back and ask your parents, like, whoa, we read about this, you know, in the book. Do you know anything about this this area having the sign up? You know, don't let the sun hit you on your head, nigger. And if you can read, or if you can't read, run anyway. Have you seen any of these signs or heard about? See what your parents have to say, your uncles, grandparents. Anyway, Washington State, I'm listening out. He said in 1907 in Bellingham, Washington, really stuck out because one of my yoga instructors just opened a studio in Bellingham, Washington, and brags about the studio being on the water and it's so pretty and all of this. I cannot wait to go up there and be like, oh, wow, this was in a book that we're just reading about. How they ran up, what did it say? Drove out its entire Hindu population, Sikhs actually, numbering between 200 and 300 during 3 days of lawlessness. The chief of police, according to a police account written years later, recognized the universal demand of the whites that the brown men be expelled. I was thinking something about this, them continuing to say, be out by nightfall, be out by sundown, be out by sun. Something about this has a black misandric feel to it. And then bang, right there, just something about the whole, you got to be out by nightfall, seems like it has an air of, this is to protect our white women. We can't have the niggers running around here potentially to rape the good white woman once the sun goes down. It has that kind of feeling to it. I could be an air. We can think about that as we proceed. Let's see. The next. When he says we've seen, this is in sundown subregions and deadlines, we've seen that entire subregions of the United States, such as the Cumberlands, the Ozarks, and the suburbs of Los Angeles, went sundown. And see, that's, again, just use that as a metaphor. Engaged in white terrorism to exclude niggers. Much better than went sundown. That's what, it's almost like a casual, that casual way of talking about this is, in my view, another act of racism. Not every suburb of Los Angeles, not every county in the Ozarks or the Cumberlands, but enough to warrant the generalization. I think that is important because even some victims, certainly many racists will say that you can't generalize about whites. The evidence is overwhelming. I've come to the same conclusion that Mr. Lowen does in the book. It's overwhelming, the evidence in terms of whites practicing racism. The evidence that he's presenting in this book to his own testimony is overwhelming. Continuing. Also, just want to note, he's citing a lot of sources that are from the time period that he's talking about, meaning that he is not just going and getting books that were written 50, 40 years after the time period. He's finding a lot of current sources to talk about things that were happening in the 1900s, white people studying. This is the same thing I noted from the Warmth of Other Suns, white people study their system. She also, Isabel Wilkerson,
was referencing books and studies, sociological studies that white people were carrying out in the 1900s and 1920s, counting the number of niggers that had migrated from Mississippi and all these places. White people are not ignorant about racism. They study their system in great detail. That's how you maintain power for centuries and centuries. Let's see. Sid. In Ohio, red in Nevada, it said the deadline was probably continued north to the Missouri Boot Heel and west beyond Paragould, encompassing more than 2,000 square miles. In southern Illinois, African Americans were not permitted to settle north of the Mobile and Ohio switch track. This had been a settled feeling for years, according to a 1924 newspaper report that described a series of attacks, arson, attempted murder, and dynamite against blacks who tried to move north of that line, and against a white farmer in Elko who hired him. I think the caller brought out before, you can't be ignorant about racism. You will get in trouble with other white people. And I also thought, wow, even 2019, if any of you, this is, you know, rhetorical, I'm just bringing it up for point, 2019, you got the internet, you got your iPhone right there. Okay, you're upset with a white person. How much, you know, how easy do you think it would be for you to get some dynamite if you wanted to go at a white person? Just, you know, right now, if you're a black person anywhere in the world listening to this program, and these folks in 1924, whites, upset, the niggers, let's get the dynamite. They didn't have Amazon. They didn't have Walmart. 1924, you don't even have a vehicle probably. They had to get a horse and dynamite. We got these niggers. Let's do it. Irie, did you have commentary? You should be with us.
Yes, thank you. Really quickly, I wanted to elaborate a little bit on what you just said about white people not being ignorant and citing sources that are, you know, of long standing, that, you know, all this data and everything. And what Ivy said about, it was something, I can't remember exactly now, and I apologize. But basically, something she said and something you just said made me think that this book is almost like voyeurism. And if people are, know what that is, I don't want to get into it, it's kind of inappropriate. But it's like a voyeuristic experience of racism for the white people that don't want to practice racism outwardly or think that they don't. You know, they're self-righteous in a way, so they probably like engage in books like this, you know, like, oh wow, like, because the word astonishing, and how could you be astonished, like how can you be astonished that racism in this degree and in this way is occurring in America? It's the bedrock of America. So that's all I want to say. Thank you. Good night, everyone. Good night, guys.
Much obliged, Irie. Last two notes I took, or that I'll share. He says, to supply an exact number of sundown towns in the United States is hard, partly because it depends on the definition of town. But in many states outside the South, a majority of all towns can probably be confirmed as sundown in 1968. That again, I mean, that's, in my view, all of this is just giving you a really clear definition of what it means to be white. Wisconsin, Indiana, California, Florida, Ohio, Nevada, Virginia, Massachusetts. It doesn't matter. What does it mean to be white? It means no niggers around here. That's what it means. Now, the other one, when he says creating all black towns, after 1900, hostility ranging from shunning to violence forced involuntary retrenchment of African Americans from dispersed housing in many parts of the city to concentration in inner city ghettos, an intra-city manifestation of the Great Retreat. There's that word again, act of racism every time it's used. But the reason I highlighted initially was because he said hostility ranging from shunning to violence. And he has a similar line that he said earlier in the text this week, the portion we read this week. He said something else, deception and acts of violence. Anytime that a white person is doing anything, if it's shunning, if it's deception, if it's just setting up covenants to not rent you, all of that is terrorism. All of that is violence. Mr. Fuller has described that as somebody is fooling you to trick you out of your money. That is violence. If somebody is tricking you, is harming you so that you can't have a safe, quality residence, that is violence. I wouldn't care if they're coming in and setting your property on fire or hitting you physically, or if they're just making it really, really difficult for you to close. They make it really difficult for you to get that loan. They make it really difficult to even get a realtor to show you that all of that is violence. Just understanding what we mean when we say violence, understanding what we mean when we say racism. But I thought that was really important. I think that's a key aspect I'll be mentioning as we proceed through the book. We'll pick up here next Thursday. James Loewen, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, White Supremacy. Tomorrow for Workplace Racism, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Saturday, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. They had my hometown in the news again for workplace racism, and it was with the school system. I was cracking up laughing. Racism is not funny, but my hometown in the news again. Sister, local, national, global. That's one thing that you can do. Just pay attention to areas that you have a connection to and be alert for when racism, white supremacy becomes a big deal. You can use that, perhaps, to talk to people that you, victims, that you care about, to use that perhaps as a way to get them to think a bit more in detail with accuracy about what racism is, how it works. If you have questions, commentary you want to share about the book, untiljustice@gmail.com, we can read your thoughts as we get through the book. With that, much obliged for all the folks who participated. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. At times, that is used as justification for removal, purging of niggers. They're drunkards. They're intoxicated. Not that that will stop whites from terrorizing us, but I think it would be better for us to be sober so that we can be mindful that these sort of attacks happen. Don't want to be out of your mind when whites come to purge, pillage, rape, practice racism. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we're in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.